From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump started the week off in New York, speaking today at a Veterans Day commemoration. But just 2 days from now, his attention will be on the first public hearings in the impeachment inquiry. Three diplomats will be questioned this week about the president's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president and whether U.S. military aid and White House meetings were withheld from Ukraine in order to get Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Let's bring in Franco Ordonez, NPR White House correspondent. Franco, Democrats are calling the shots in these hearings. On ABC yesterday, Democrat and House Intelligence Committee member Jackie Speier made the case against President Trump.
The president broke the law. He went on a telephone call with the president of Ukraine and said, "I have a favor, though," and then proceeded to ask for an investigation of his rival. And this is a very strong case of bribery.
Now, the hearings this week, the public hearings, will begin with distinguished diplomats William Taylor, George Kent, and Marie Yovanovitch. What are they expected to say?
Well, all three have already testified in private of the administration putting pressure on Ukraine to launch an investigation of a political rival. Now people are going to hear them directly for themselves. Taylor testified it was his clear understanding that security aid would not come until the Ukraine president committed to doing an investigation. And Kent, he was the one who described a, quote, campaign of lies led by Rudy Giuliani to undermine Yovanovitch.
Let's listen to what Republicans have been saying. Here's Texas Republican Mac Thornberry, the ranking Republican on the House Armed Services Committee, speaking on ABC yesterday.
I believe that it is inappropriate for a president to ask a foreign leader to investigate a political rival. Now, it leads to a question. If there's a political rival with a family member who's involved in questionable activity, what do? Just let them alone. But set that aside. I believe it was inappropriate. I do not believe it was impeachable.
Inappropriate but not impeachable. Is that going to be what we're going to hear from Republicans this week?
It could be. Certainly, it's one of the strategies the Republicans have taken. I can tell you, though, it's certainly not strong enough for President Trump. He tweeted Sunday about Republicans not getting caught in a, quote, fool's trap of raising concern about the July 25th call, but not just arguing that it's not impeachable. He insists that nothing was done wrong, and he wants Republicans to carry that message. The reality is, though, Republicans have struggled to come up with a consensus on how to defend this president.
Now, the White House has tried to stop many people from testifying in the impeachment inquiry, and many haven't testified yet, but a number of people, including the White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, have signed onto a lawsuit basically asking a judge to decide if they should testify against the White House's wishes. Might we get some answers to that today?
Yeah, the lawsuit was filed by the attorney for former National Security Advisor John Bolton and his deputy Charles Kupperman. The judge in that case has ordered the lawyers for all three of them, including Mick Mulvaney's lawyer, in a conference call this afternoon to discuss Mulvaney's request and how to proceed. So we could get some answers. It's worth noting, though, that Mulvaney has hired his own private attorney. You know, he's still the acting chief of staff, so this indicates at least some level of independence that he wants from the White House.
Meanwhile, more transcripts are likely to be coming out this week. What are we expecting there?
Well, you know, so many are already out, but there are still a few left to come out. Tim Morrison, the top Russia and Europe advisor on the National Security Council, also Laura Cooper, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia in the Ukraine. So there are still some more that could come out.
And what's your sense, Franco, of the mood in the White House going into this week?
You know, it's a tense time. This has taken a lot of the White House's oxygen. It just makes it harder to do so much other work. Even aides such as Larry Kudlow, director of the National Economic Council, this is obviously not his lane, and he's having to answer questions about the Ukraine transcript. And you really see that frustration in the president's tweets, including tweets this weekend charging that this all is a witch hunt, that this is a presidential harassment, and as we said earlier, even against Republicans themselves.
And obviously, a lot of people are going to be watching and listening to the hearings this week. Many NPR stations will be carrying them live. Do you expect public support on impeachment to change?
Well, it's wavered. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on the party that you're in. If you're a Democrat, you certainly support the impeachment effort. If you're a Republican, you don't.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
To Bolivia now, where there was chaos in the streets overnight after the military forced out the country's president yesterday. Evo Morales says he was a victim of a coup, but his opponents accuse him of rigging the vote in a disputed election last month. Joining us now for more is Katie Watson, South America correspondent for the BBC. She's in La Paz, Bolivia. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
And Katie, we're reading reports of Morales supporters blockading the country's main airport, crowds in the streets. What are you seeing in Bolivia today?
So the streets in La Paz are actually eerily quiet. Overnight after his resignation, there was celebration, but it did then turn to violence in some parts. There was looting and vandalism. So when we were in the streets just earlier, a lot of areas that are normally bustling, you know, like market days, there was hardly anybody in the streets. And very few shops open because of this concern, because of the violence. So people seem to be staying away, certainly, in the morning after.
Morales' resignation has left a power vacuum in Bolivia. What do we know about who's going to step in to fill in?
Well, that's the big question, because normally when the president steps down, then there's the vice president. After that, it would go to the president of the Senate and then the lower house. But all of these people have vacated their roles. So currently, there is a big concern. An opposition senator is talking about taking over. I mean, this is the concern at the moment. Where does Bolivia go now? With the uncertainty of who is going to be in charge, and not just who's going to be in charge, but when elections are going to be called, because it's meant to be within 90 days. So a lot could happen very quickly. But for now, everybody's just watching and waiting to see. In this, of course, a country that is one of the poorest in the region and one of the most kind of historically unstable as well.
Thank you for that context. And let's step back for a moment and look at why this is happening. So opponents of Morales accuse him of rigging the election back on October 20th. A team from the Organization of American States conducted an investigation, and they say they found irregularities in the vote count. What evidence has this organization provided?
So what happened was, and I in fact was here for the vote, was on the Sunday night of the vote, they counted about 85% of all the votes, and then the count stopped. And then people were questioning exactly what happened. It was the unofficial count. But then the following day, it was a recount. The official count came through. And Evo Morales on the Sunday looked like he was going to have to go through to a second round. By the time all the votes were counted, it looked like he had actually won the elections outright. And that's at that point, the opposition cried foul and said there had been fraud. The Organization of American States said they'd look into this. And they announced over the weekend, this past weekend, that there had been clear manipulation, there had been forged signatures, data manipulation, you know, that sort of thing, that they couldn't possibly verify the votes and that the vote should be annulled. And in fact, Evo Morales, to his credit, did actually say that, yes, we can run a fresh vote. But the problem was, is that people felt, well, the first time that it was a dirty vote. So how do we know that it's going to be clean the second time?
Yeah, you mentioned this new election, and Morales agreed to a new election before resigning. But this all happened so fast. He seemed to lose the support of police and the military very rapidly. What do you think changed over the last day or two?
To be fair, I mean, the military's not, he's not been, you know, hugely close to them. And I think that's what's quite interesting is that Evo Morales doesn't have, I mean, if you compare, for example, Nicolas Maduro, who is a close ally in Venezuela, and the army there has remained very loyal so far to Nicolas Maduro. And Evo doesn't have that relationship with the armed forces. And I think that's the concern, is that he may not have been the choice of many people, and a lot of people want to see him gone. But the fact that the military have told him to step down makes you wonder what that now means for Bolivia and, you know, a route to democracy, especially with this power vacuum. It's certainly an uncomfortable time for Bolivia and the future and the stability for this country.
Remind us of Morales's impact on Bolivia. He was the first indigenous president. He's credited with cutting poverty while improving the country's GDP. And although you say he's been very unpopular with police and the military, he seems to be popular among many Bolivians. I'm just wondering about concern over whether the person that replaces him as president will have the ability to win the favor of his supporters.
Well, I mean, he has support among the police as well. I mean, he's still got a huge amount of support across Bolivia. He's a man, as you said, who, you know, the first indigenous president in the country. He promised social inclusion in a deeply divided society, so a deeply unequal society. And I've spoken to Bolivians who say that he made people feel proud of being Bolivian. He's given that kind of voice to many millions, and that's where his support base is, especially coming from rural areas. But, you know, the issue is that his popularity has waned in the last few years because of his democratic values. People have felt that he's wanted to hang on to power too long, and that's the concern. But there's no doubt he has improved this country in some ways. Even people who criticize him would concede that there have been some positive aspects to his presidency.
That's Katie Watson, South America correspondent with the BBC in La Paz, Bolivia. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thanks.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
New York Times bestselling author Neil Pasricha has a new book out called You Are Awesome. That's the title. Pasricha worked in the business world at Procter & Gamble and Walmart before turning his attention to the study of happiness. And in his new book, he says a key part of happiness is learning how to deal with failure. Neil, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And who are you talking to in this book?
I'm talking to myself. I'm talking to my kids. I'm talking to anyone out there who has thin skin, who feels a little bit more anxious than they should. Considering we live in the greatest time ever to be alive, why are we feeling so fragile and frail? I'm talking to people that think that way, and I know I'm one of those people.
And why do you think we are?
Well, we grew up, you know, in the 80s getting gold stars, participation ribbons. You can press a button these days and a car whisks you home. You have takeout waiting on your front porch. Your cell phone entertains you. We live like kings. But the side effect of living like that is that we no longer have the tools to handle failure or even perceived failure. And our cell phones feed us an endless list of people who are better than us, better looking than us, have more friends than us, have more followers than us. If you get 2 likes on your photos, of course you feel like you got no friends. If your boss sends you a rude email, of course you feel like, you know, I got to call in sick. I can't handle this kind of pain. We have a fragility problem today.
Well, and you start the book with a story about your mom in Nairobi, Kenya, and how her early life was a series of setbacks that could have stopped her but didn't.
Mm-hmm. She was born the fifth girl in a family of 8, praying for a fourth boy in East Africa, which of course gives the boys the resources, the money for education and so on. She was ushered into an arranged marriage to a guy she met once before, who then flung her across the ocean to North America, where they settled in a town where she knew nobody. And throughout this experience, as she told me as I was growing up, whether he was taking her to, you know, the local German pavilion to do ballroom dancing, or whether he was taking her to a barbecue and she never ate meat before, but suddenly all there is burgers and hot dogs. She just added the word yet to her mentality. Hmm. So the idea was, I don't ballroom dance yet, or I don't eat meat yet. And as she told me these stories when I was a kid, it stuck with me as an adult because I realized most of us talk in this way, where we talk to ourselves with a period at the end of the sentence. Your pitch gets rejected, you think, I'm not creative. Your doctor gives you a health test back and then you got bad cholesterol. You think, I don't take care of myself. You go to law school because it's, you know, where you got in. You think, I don't have any other options, right? No offense to the lawyers out there. But I just say that because if you just rephrase those thoughts as, I'm not creative yet. I don't take care of myself yet. I don't have any other options yet. What you're doing is what I call resilience. You are seeing the tiny sliver of light that exists right between the door and the frame just after you hear the latch click. I think resilience is this muscle that we all need to build, and just this mentality of letting the future possibility maybe include a yet helps us get there a little bit.
Well, and you say in this book, we're born with endless possibilities and we die with none, and we need to keep those options, those possibilities open as long as possible, which is against our preference.
Yes, exactly. The world these days is trying to specialize us. Look, how many people have been put, or their parents, there are parents putting their kids in like cello lessons when they're six or whatever like that. You know, the discipline right now is to study as hard as possible in one specific thing, because how are you going to succeed or do well in this world when everybody else is so super specialized and everybody's going to have more skills than you are if you don't go deep in one area? But while researching this book, I came across an amazing study that showed Nobel Prize winners actually are 22 times more likely than their scientist peers to actually have a totally unrelated hobby outside their scientific profession, meaning that they're also glass blowing on the side or starring in the local town play, or they're playing a sport that they're not very good at. Having these other hobbies or weird experiences or weird hobbies, as I like to call them, actually makes us more mentally tough. Our learning rate is the steepest when we know the least about it. But as adults, so many of us get fragile because we end up staying down one path. As you said, we need to keep our options open. And the way to do that is always have a weird hobby. Be trying new things all the time.
So you have a number of secrets, as you call them, in this book that you are imparting on the readers. And one of them is that you should tell yourself a different story. What do you mean by that?
So this takes me back to grade 9 gym class, a place that many of us probably don't want to revisit. I remember once my gym teacher, like this kind of big, burly, sort of Eastern European bodybuilder guy, he was telling this story in front of the whole room of 30 grade 9 boys. And he says, you know, one time I was wrestling this guy in a tournament and I actually squished the guy's testicle. And the whole room groaned and was like, oh, man. And then he says, yeah, after that, we all called him half a man. And the room just erupted in laughs and cheer. This is the best joke of the semester from this guy.
Not for you, though.
Not for me. At that moment, Jeremy, I just realized, I'm like, that's me. He's talking about me. I never realized you're supposed to have two. You have one nose, you got one heart, you got one stomach. This made sense to me. I was filled with an extremely deep sense of shame. And as I was researching this book on resilience, what I realized is so many of us do that. I was telling myself all kinds of stories, Jeremy. I was saying, I'm unlovable. I'll never get married. I'm disfigured. I won't have kids. I'll have a high-pitched voice. I can't play contact sports. We all do this. You fail biology, you tell yourself, I failed my parents. You're an alcoholic, you tell yourself, nobody trusts me. Part of developing resilience is learning to tell yourself a different story. Okay, you have to husk away all the like things you've lacquered on top of the core objective truth and learn to peel them away. I say there's three questions to doing that. Number one is, will this matter on my deathbed? Number two is, can I do something about this? If you can, great. If you can't, well, you can. So you have to move on. And number three is this a story I'm telling myself? Again, can you separate the fact from the stories you're telling yourself? These three things are very important because in order to develop resilience, we need to figure out what's true and what is just a lie that we're telling ourselves.
Well, and I guess the other part of that is that we have more control over the situation than we think we do.
Absolutely. Here's the thing. Right now, if you are alive in the world today, you are probably spending a lot of time on the internet, right? What does the internet tell you? I always say there's three problems. They all start with letter P. There are productivity problems. You aren't getting anything done because you're bookmarking, prioritizing, and switching between tasks. There's a psychological problem because you're comparing everybody else's greatest hits with your director's cut life. And there's a physiological problem. You're looking at bright screens before bed. That reduces melatonin. You don't sleep as well. And guess what happens in the morning, Jeremy? You have lower resilience because you didn't have a deep sleep. People these days are always talking about intermittent fasting, you know, don't eat between dinner and breakfast. Try to stay off of food. It helps your body. What I think we are in desperate need of today is an intermittent fasting every day on technology.
Well, and we spoke with an author recently who's got a book out called Digital Minimalism about exactly that.
Yes.
And basically he's a professor as well and got his students to give up devices for 30 days. And apparently for the first 2 weeks, it was extremely difficult for them. But after that, they start to realize all the other things they're getting done in that time.
Yeah, this is very similar. So Cal Newport, a great guy,
right.
and you are awesome. I write about something I call untouchable days. And I wrote this independently of Cal. So in You Are Awesome, Chapter 8, I call them untouchable days. One day a week, would you believe I'm completely untethered? My wife doesn't know where I am. I have no internet access on my computer. And guess what, Jeremy? In those days, that's where I get all my writing done. That's where I can actually produce the podcast that I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a 10x output increase in my creative work. Sometimes people say to me, oh, Neil, it's so nice that you can do that, but I can't. I'm a nurse or I'm taking care of someone super busy. And I say, but could you take an untouchable lunch? Could you just leave your cell phone at your desk for an hour and maybe go for a walk? We know if you can do that, you reset your body and your strength in your mind goes up. That's why it's such a big part of my book.
So why do you think so few people actually do that?
Well, technology is very seductive and very addictive, okay? Look, if you drank a bottle of wine right before you went to bed, and if you woke up and drank a bottle of wine and you slept with a bottle of wine, we'd probably call you an alcoholic. But right now, if I'm in a room of people and I say, how many people sleep with their cell phone within 5 feet of their heads when they're sleeping? Every single hand, pretty much, like 99% of people, put their hand up. When everyone has an addiction, it is more difficult to see. And so we all have NDD right now, nature deficit disorder. And a big part of this lowering of our mental resilience is because we're endlessly comparing ourselves to people that are better than us. No matter how good the lunch you and I have together today, somebody's at a lobster buffet in the Maldives, right, on Instagram. So you are in a permanent state of anxiety because you can't win anymore.
Neil Pasricha, this book is a result of a lot of the things you've learned in your career and your life. Did you learn anything new while you were writing this book? Because this is not the first book that you've written even about awesomeness. So you've written The Happiness Equation. You've written The Book of Awesome. Now this is You Are Awesome. What did you learn?
One of the biggest takeaways I found in the research was something called the end of history illusion. You know, one of my jobs when I was at Walmart, Jeremy, was actually I had to help people get fired. I had to help them walk to their trunk and pack up their boxes. It was a terrible job. And they'd always say to me the same thing, which is, what am I going to do now? I'll never find anything. My life is over. When I'd bump into those people 5 years later, they'd say, guess what? Getting fired was the best thing that ever happened to me. I started a new business that I'd always been dreaming about. I got to spend time with my daughter after she had her miscarriage. I got to go visit my parents in our home country of Peru. Whatever it was, they had to reposition it in their mind. I didn't make sense of that until I read a study called The End of History Illusion. It turns out, from a resilience standpoint, we all catastrophize. We think where we are today is where we're going to be forever. Unfortunately, if that means if you lost your job or you got dumped or something went bad, you think you're stuck there. Mm-hmm. But use the end of history illusion to actually reimagine that this could be a step towards a future that you just can't see yet.
That is Neil Pasricha, whose new book, You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. Neil, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And you can read an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org and then take a little break from your screen. You'll like it. Anti-government protests in Hong Kong escalated today. A protester was shot by police amid clashes that have increasingly marked the pro-democracy demonstrations that have been going on for months. Joining us now is NPR Southeast Asia correspondent Julie McCarthy. She's in Hong Kong. Julie, what did you see today?
I saw an almost curious, if I could call it, efficiency that's evolved here. It takes minutes for protesters to cobble together everything around the streets, bricks, metal rods, barricades, and stop traffic. And it takes the police just minutes to come in and change all that. And the police, what changed today was after the police cleared these things with great efficiency and the protesters disperse with sprinting that is worthy of the Olympics. It's extraordinary how they just whoosh, they're gone. The police were stopping people who happened to be in the area and interrogating them. And the major criticism against the police is that they've strayed too far from discipline, that its tactics have become too heavy-handed. And that's for the residents of Sai Wan Ho. The police are worthy of the loudest criticism, condemnation, because they... it was there that they shot, in their neighborhood, they shot a 21-year-old student today, who tonight is in intensive care. And I think what was happening in that neighborhood of Sai Wan Ho, it was kind of emblematic of what's going on in Hong Kong. Certainly over the weekend, things were starting to build, and it just kind of came to this climax today.
Well, and everyone wonders what happens next. Carrie Lam, who is Hong Kong's leader, spoke to reporters today. What did she say?
Well, Carrie Lam basically said if anyone thinks that by upping the violence ante here in Hong Kong is going to pressure the government into acceding to the protesters' demands, they are engaged in wishful thinking. And, you know, that left people kind of with their eyes popped open and thinking, are we headed for a harsher crackdown? So what she said, I think, is kind of fuel for speculation about where it is headed. But there's no question, Jeremy, that there is a new, deeper polarization. There is a new volatility. There is a deeper hostility. You even hear it in the chants. You know, we've gone a long way from be water, if you remember that chant, you know, kind of slip away whenever you need to and the authorities are around, be water. And now the battle cry is Hong Kong revenge. So there's definitely a hardening here.
A hardening, and you say Carrie Lam said it's wishful thinking for the protesters to think that they're going to get what they're asking for. What about the protesters? Mm-hmm. Do they still have hope that they will be able to get what they're asking for, which is really democracy in Hong Kong?
Boy, you know, that's the key question in all of this. A lot of protesters will tell you, we have to be here. You know, whether we believe we're going to get it or not, the fight for that is so important that it compels us to be out here. Of course, we want it to happen. You know, the realists, the rationalists, if you want to call them, would say, you know, the chances of this happening with Beijing as the overseer of Hong Kong are extremely remote. Mm-hmm. But there are, you know, there are still rather, you know, there are pragmatic people. And you know, you can call them idealists, you can call them dreamers, but they're still out there and they believe that they can somehow save Hong Kong for their own future and a future they want that's free and that's democratic.
NPR's Julie McCarthy in Hong Kong. Julie, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
In Matamoros, Mexico, at the U.S. southern border, more than 1,500 asylum seekers are living in squalid conditions. They're waiting for their hearings as part of President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy. For more, we're joined by Margaret Huang, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. Welcome.
I appreciate being here.
So you were recently at the U.S.-Mexico border with a group of delegates from around the world, and you visited Matamoros, the Mexican city on the other side of Brownsville, Texas. Describe what you saw there.
It was quite a surprise. As someone who's been to many, many parts of the world and has seen many refugee camps, it was truly stunning to see an open-air refugee camp on the border of the United States. Matamoros has more than 1,500 people sitting in tents on a concrete plaza just at the edge of the bridge where you cross over from the United States into Mexico.
And describe more of the details on what you saw when you were there. There were folks in tents right at the border. What were the conditions there?
The conditions are abysmal. Many of the camp's residents are children. I would say probably at least half are children. There are 5 porta-potties that have been provided by the local government for the more than 1,500 people living in the camp.
Wow.
There's not a single hand-washing station that is functioning. There was one. It's now broken. So there's literally no place for these people to wash their hands, to prepare their meals, to take care of their children.
And give us a little bit of context here. This is in light of President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy. How is that impacting this situation?
Well, it's entirely caused by the president's policies. The so-called Remain in Mexico program, which requires asylum seekers to be returned to Mexico while they await their hearings in U.S. courts, is what has created this crisis in Matamoros. Those people in the tents have only arrived since July, which is when the Migration Protection Protocol, which is very inaptly named, was first established in Brownsville. I think the challenge is by sending these asylum seekers into Mexico that the administration's policies is making their plight more invisible. We can't see them because the refugee camps aren't in the United States. They're across the border. And the people who come back for their asylum hearings are barely in the country for a few hours sitting in a port of entry. They're not given the opportunity to meet with their lawyers in person, to perhaps speak with family members. Many of them have no way of communicating with family in the camps.
Tell me about the different places that they're coming from.
I think the majority are coming from Honduras and El Salvador. There are also refugees fleeing from Guatemala, from Cuba, from Venezuela, and Nicaragua. These are people who are so desperate that they've made the journey of several thousand miles to come to this border. And they cross the border and they make their asylum claim, and they're immediately returned to some of the most dangerous cities in Mexico. The reason that there's no international institution in Matamoros operating the refugee camp is because it's too dangerous. The U.S. State Department warns U.S. citizens not to go to that city, and the international institutions have security bars that prevent them from operating in Matamoros.
I want to talk a little bit about what the administration is saying about all of this. So former Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Kevin McAleenan says that the scale of the crisis at the border is so enormous. According to his numbers, in May, U.S. Customs and Border Protection apprehended or encountered more than 144,000 migrants at the southwest border, and 90% of them, he says, was trying to cross illegally. He also mentions that you mentioned the parents being separated, but that so many of these minors are unaccompanied. And that is part of the reason why the administration pushed for longer than 20 days. Of course, a court ruling rejected that idea of having kids in custody for more than 20 days. What is your response to this?
So first, it's really important for everyone to note that it is absolutely legal for anyone seeking asylum to cross a border without papers. If you're crossing a border without the intention to seek asylum, then that's a different category. But for all the people who are crossing, fleeing violence, seeking shelter and safety for their lives, it is legal to cross the border without any documentation. So it's problematic when the administration conflates all border crossers as the same. Secondly, there are a significant number of people who did approach the border last year. But if you're looking at the statistical numbers over the last two decades, the number of people seeking to cross the U.S. border right now is not at an all-time high. In fact, we're several thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands less than in previous years when the numbers have been much, much higher. So, yes, there are significant numbers of people fleeing violence, gang violence, drug cartels across Central America and in other parts of South America. Many of them are trying to get to the United States where they might have family or loved ones. And it is not at an all-time high. So the notion that this is a crisis, it's actually a manufactured crisis. And the crisis is the one that's being caused by the administration's policies, forcing so many of these vulnerable people to sit in very dangerous and abysmal conditions across the border.
We learned over the last few months from various sources, including the ACLU, that there have been as many as 5,400 children separated from their parents at the border since July of 2017. Your organization has also been tracking the numbers and putting pressure on Customs Border Patrol to release these numbers. Can you tell me more about your efforts and some of the challenges in getting those accurate numbers?
Well, there's so many challenges, unfortunately. What I can share with you is that those separations actually started before the formal policy was adopted last year in 2018 and have continued since the policy was formally disestablished. In fact, today, under that so-called Remain in Mexico policy, families are still being separated. Children are being asked to choose between one parent who might be allowed to stay in the United States and another parent who has returned to Mexico. They're also being torn away from family if the parents are deemed to be eligible to be returned to Mexico and the children don't want to be returned. So it's a situation that continues, which makes the accounting of the numbers quite difficult. And it's all being done by Customs and Border Patrol, which actually don't have any custody over the children. So the children are being handed over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement in Health and Human Services. The Office of Refugee Resettlement acknowledges that they are out of compliance with Flores in all cases. The Flores rules and regulations that were agreed upon by the court and the U.S. government were that children could not be detained for more than 20 days. There is There are no children, no unaccompanied children who are being released from OR custody in less than 20 days. Mm. The best cases are children whose parents are, in fact, in the country. Their legal guardians are here. And those cases are taking approximately 30 days to resolve. Children who might have more distant family members or a family friend as their sponsor can take several months. And children who do not have a sponsor in the United States have taken years. The number of agencies involved, the lack of tracking systems that have been set up to ensure that families can find one another, makes this process so much harder.
You traveled again with an international group of delegates because you see this as a global issue of what's happening here at the U.S.-Mexico border. What's been the response from those other delegates about their situations there and perhaps lessons learned that they're going back with?
Well, so many of them were shocked to see that the United States was such an unwelcoming place. I think the reputation of the United States as a welcoming country, as a place where immigrants and refugees have long sought to improve their lives and to find safety, has been deeply challenged by the policies of this administration. And I think many of our colleagues are recognizing that they can no longer look to the United States for lessons on how to welcome and integrate newcomers into our society.
Margaret Hwang, she's executive director of Amnesty International USA. Thank you so much, Margaret, for taking the time.
Thank you, Tanya.
Mandalorian. Look outside.
Disney's new Star Wars spinoff series, The Mandalorian, launches tomorrow, kicking off Disney's new streaming service called Disney Plus, which will feature Disney content from Bambi to Captain Marvel for around $7 a month. And our next guest says Netflix should be scared. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Disney offering its own streaming service. What's going on?
Yes, its own streaming service. Disney Plus is going to be a juggernaut. This is thousands and thousands of hours of Disney content. As you said, their famous animated films, the Marvel franchise, the Star Wars films, the Pixar movies, National Geographic content. And then also, because Disney bought Fox last year, Disney Plus will also be the home to shows that you might associate with Fox, like The Simpsons. And yet, that's not all. Like every streaming platform, it's also going to have new shows and original movies like The Mandalorian, which you sort of previewed at the beginning of the segment, and also a remake of Lady and the Tramp, which is coming out relatively soon. I feel like, you know, it can sound, as you're listing all of these things on Disney Plus, like a bit of an advertisement for Disney, which is not my intent here. But this is a sign of how dominant the company's position in entertainment has become and why this strategy, a new strategy for the king of American entertainment, is so fascinating to people like me who study this for a living.
You call it the king there, but you also call it the House of Mouse, which I love. Why do they need to get into streaming, though, and aren't they a little late to the party?
They are late to the party, and you could think, why enter the party in the first place? Disney has no need to get into streaming. It's strong enough as it is. They have the top four films released in 2019, all Disney. The most valuable television channel in the cable bundle, ESPN, also owned by Disney. So why would this company embark on a streaming strategy that arguably accelerates cord cutting and reduces the power of both of those businesses I just named, the cable bundle and the box office? Well, the bet is that the future of television, the future of entertainment, will be streamed. The cable bundle is in decline. Movie tickets bought per capita are also in decline. What's growing is streaming. And Disney is essentially saying here, if we want to be a part of that future, we need to control the relationship between our content and our consumers. And the best way to do that is to create its own version of Netflix, what I last year called Disneyflix, but now is officially called Disney Plus.
And is there enough demand for all of these streaming services aside from Disney Plus? Of course, there's Netflix, there's Amazon, there's Hulu, there's NBC's Peacock, there's HBO Max, which, by the way, is different than HBO Go and HBO Now. It's the new HBO streaming service coming next year.
It's a lot. I mean, I think you are on solid ground saying that it's a little bit ironic that we unbundled the cable bundle only to create 7 different individual streaming accounts that we have to buy, which might ironically cost more than the cable bundle we were supposedly trying to disrupt. So there was a Wall Street Journal poll that just came out this past week that said that Americans are willing to spend an average of $44 a month on streaming video. They currently are spending a lot less than that. But at some point, when you add it all up, Netflix and Amazon and HBO Max and Disney Plus, Americans are going to have to make some decisions, and some of these companies are simply not going to make the cut. I think Disney's bet is we can make the cut because our history, our franchises, our intellectual property or IP is so valuable that we can merchandise it over and over and over again the same way we've shown that we can do that in the box office every single year for the past decade. If you look at the most popular movies, they're all Disney franchises, basically. So Disney's saying, look, if it's worked at the box office, it can work streaming directly to the television sitting on front of your couch.
You know, the ironic thing about unbundling is that often in order to get these streaming services, you have to get your internet from a cable provider that probably if you spend another $10 a month, you could have the cable too, depending on the package that you're getting. Derek, where does this mean we are going in terms of what we'll be watching in the next decade?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what you're seeing right now is a battle royale playing out between Netflix and Disney and Amazon. And one thing that I think is really fascinating, a little wrinkle here, is that the television business used to be about television. But the future of the television business, weirdly, isn't. Disney Plus, in many ways, is most valuable because Disney can use this relationship with its customers to get data that it can use to sell cruises or discounted tickets to Disneyland. You look at Amazon. It's in the TV business not just to sell advertising, but because it wants to sell you a Prime membership subscription. Mm-hmm. So you buy more stuff for 2-day delivery. You know, look at Apple, which is also in their television. They're not doing it for advertising. They're doing it to sell more phones. So I think it's fascinating to think that the future of the TV business is not, in fact, the TV business. It's television as a means of selling something bigger.
And we hear the Disney music coming in the background here, Derek, which means it's time to go and let Sebastian take over. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more are you looking for? Under the sea, under the sea.
Nice to hear Sebastian, Tanya, don't you think?
Always. Here takes you back to my childhood.
Me too. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
Down you or the fish is happy as off through the waves they roll. The fish on the land ain't happy this hot Thursday.